Cliff Central Revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Sunday night, Nogan. Welcome to the show. It's Frankly Speaking, 9 until 10 in the morning. Thank you to Gareth and the gang. Rorosang Shavalala Dumelang.
Sean Pincham.
Dati. Legay.
Rotten Legay.
Robert Simonat.
I am an intro. How many times must I tell you?
I'm sorry. What?
I'm a Robert.
What is it?
Get close to Monat now.
But maybe I'm speaking Tswana.
No.
And I don't even know it.
No, leave
That's
it.
How good I am.
No.
So we saw a whole bunch of shenanigans and fighting yesterday. How did you feel the AFF did, if you were like calling the fight?
No comment, but I think it touches on the big point of today. Is the Rainbow Nation a fallacy? Once upon a time, we dreamt about seeing a parliament that's dominated by black people making laws that govern that prefer or represent a majority of the country. That is what parliament has descended into, and I imagine a lot of people are asking, was this Rainbow Nation thing a pipe dream? We see the things that are happening with the judge, was it Judge Jansen, mm-hmm. and Matt Tiernison, Penny Sparrow. Is this Rainbow Nation thing a fallacy? So that was coined by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And now, if you look at what's happening in Vuani, if you look what's happened on UJ campus, if you just look at just the discontent in the country.
Just be careful, Rory. Rory, you're killing me. You're sounding a bit more like Sihle every day here.
Hey, don't call me Sihle. Don't even go there. No.
Please. All right, well, we got an amazing guest in studio today. His name is Lebogang Rasithaba. He is the man, the thinker, behind the People versus the Rainbow Nation. He's going to be chatting to us in studio this morning. Hey, if you want to get in touch with us, hook us up on Twitter. We want to hear from you. Do you think the Rainbow Nation is a farce? Yes or no, and why, and or why not? You can tweet us at Rorisang. Shabalala, or at Yebo_Levy. Those are the details. We'll take some of those tweets a little bit later on in the show. But hey, let's start it out like this.
I think like it's about to get really intense in South Africa.
The whole system is very, very anti-poor and very, very anti-black.
I think white people need to take an L and say, okay, we screwed up and we can't always be the father figure.
Success for a white kid is not like a great victory. Success for a white kid is destined.
It's not so much about engaging in conversation, really. It's more about listening.
If you're uncomfortable with me being a black person, then yeah, you know you're in the wrong country.
I don't believe in the Rainbow Nation. The Rainbow Nation to me is a fallacy because it does not exist.
Wow. That is pretty radical. Lebogang Rasithaba, good morning.
What's up?
How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm so good. You know, you're the most stylish guy that I've met, eh? For real, like every time I see you, you've got some stylish thing going on. I actually mistook you for David Clally the other day because you look so stylish, man. Especially that beanie. I love that beanie.
Well, good thing we're here to talk about the film, right?
You
know, I was about to say to you, like,
what are you
do all black people look the same? David Clally, of all people.
What's wrong with David Clally?
Is that the one fashion, is that the one black
the
fashion designer
black
you know?
I know.
Exactly.
The only black guy. What are you talking about? We're talking about, is the Rainbow Nation a farce here? And frankly speaking, Lebogang, what made you decide to come up with this concept of doing this docu?
Actually, it was MTV that came up to me, and they were just like, we want to give a young filmmaker a platform to make a film that is reflective of the times in a way in which it looks at the most recent topical things. In fact, initially they said we want to make a documentary about race. I was like, that is like a terrible idea. Because how do you make a film about race, you know?
Mm.
It's like you can't make that film. But you can make something that deals with issues of power in society. And mm-hmm. I think that that's what the film is about. And that's what, the moment I realized that, that's when it became interesting to me that it's not specifically about race. Because how do you, I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, race was something that was constructed a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as old as time.
Mm.
So you don't, like, how would you even begin to make that film? But if you want to talk about power is something that is continually you know, like reorganizing itself, reshaping itself, becoming more or less insidious, you know. At other times, it's like really heightened. You know, if you look at somewhere like America, you know, Black Lives Matter speaks to power that's being exercised at a very brute kind of level. That's like more directly like white cops are killing black kids because certain ways of like an appearance has been criminalized. Mm-hmm. So that's like a really extreme form of power. But then you kind of move around the world and you realize that maybe it's not so crudely articulated in different parts of the world, but you come to a place like South Africa and, you know, we talk about the Rainbow Nation, and then you're like, okay, well then if we accept the philosophy of the Rainbow Nation, then we should be living in a certain type of society, and the reality is that we're not. And I think that that's kind of where the film kind of takes shape.
Lebo, just take us back to this idea of the Rainbow Nation, its origins, and so you've set the film against this concept of the Rainbow Nation. What is this thing called the Rainbow Nation? Many of us hear it, but we don't know what it actually means.
Funnily enough, I did a lot of research on what the Rainbow Nation is, and it became popular in 1994, but it has been around since like the early 1900s. Mm. So if you read about the idea of the Rainbow Nation, it's something that was established like during the days when the first settlers arrived on the continent, and they looked and there was all these different people of color living in the same space.
Mm.
That is kind of, it's like the its earliest articulations was based on like the Hottentots and the, and you know, when the Europeans came with the slaves, and you know, that present, like there were people from Cape Malay, there were people from all different parts of the world that came down in the great kind of whatever, you know. So
its inception wasn't in 94, but it certainly took on a different meaning in 94, right?
Exactly, because in 94, the version of the Rainbow Nation that we live with is based on equality. So back then, it wasn't really based on equality. It just spoke to lots of different people living together. Yeah, diversity, exactly. But now it's like, okay, we all live as diverse as we are, and you can move freely as a black person, as a white person, as a woman, as a man, as a disabled person, as all these different things, without any of those things that I mentioned about, forms of power, separating you.
Mm.
That is the kind of the ideal of the Rainbow Nation.
Go for it. I've got so many questions for this guy. I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, so then tell us about the film. So against this backdrop of this Rainbow Nation, you come up with this film called, you know, The People versus the Rainbow Nation. So describe where the people are and where the Rainbow Nation is, and why then you create this versus setup.
I mean, okay, so if maybe we were to look at the metaphor of a court case, which is the idea of, you know, something being brought to task, right? And it was tricky because the team was like, well, in a court case, if it's the people versus, you know, it was the state versus Nelson Mandela and the Rivonia trial, you know, that type of language, you hear both sides of the argument, right?
Yeah.
So that was the biggest challenge that we had, was like, you don't really hear the other side,
the other,
right?
Side, yeah.
You hear one side, and well, you only hear the side of the people.
Let me interject there. So who would be on the side of the Rainbow Nation then?
The people that would be on the side of the Rainbow Nation are the people that benefit from the myth of the Rainbow Nation.
Mm. Are those white people? Can we just stipulate it? Because, you know, it's a valid question.
It's not exclusively white people. Because there's also black people that benefit from the myth of the Rainbow Nation. There's also a whole bunch of... It's not an exclusively white thing.
Mm.
You know? There is people within the ANC, people that are in power, people that are, you know, there's a lot of people that love the idea of the Rainbow Nation. And also, to be clear, I also love the ideals of the Rainbow Nation. I want to live in a Rainbow Nation society, but I'm under no misconception that we're already living in it.
Level, let's just, we need to just paint a picture. What are these ideals of a Rainbow Nation? So that we understand what we're talking about. So you speak about Rainbow Nation as a term existing since the 1900s. 1994, it took on a new meaning. What is that meaning, if you were to summarize it?
The way I best understand it, without being some kind of spokesperson for Desmond Tutu, is that it's a society in which all people are equal, regardless of race, gender, class, Yeah, so think about the principles of equality.
Mm.
That you don't get paid more because you're a man. You don't get paid more because you're white. You don't get paid more because you're disabled. I mean, able-bodied.
Mm.
All of these people, you know, is, yeah.
So equality and diversity, which then speaks to the motto of the country.
Exactly. Mm. I mean, different, all these colors that, like, live in kind of some kind of like harmonious kind of, you know?
Yeah. But isn't that the problem? Isn't a rainbow the problem, Randrew? Is that these colors are, don't live, they live side by side in perfect harmony. Ebony and ivory.
Are you about to break under song? Because I would like to cut this show short if that's the case.
And ivory.
No, guys, please. I'm dulling your mics. That's horrible. That is horrible right there.
But isn't that the problem? Is that we've never really transitioned from living, because we lived together. It wasn't harmonious, but it was, we were living side by side. And we haven't gotten to that point where there's this integration. Isn't that the problem?
You know, just sorry to interject there, because I know you're asking this question to Lebo, but I like to put my, you know, sixth sense on the table here. You mentioned equality, and it gave me this visualization of some kind of a scale where there were people who weren't equal beforehand. And if they weren't equal beforehand, it means that you have to lift them up a little bit higher than afterwards to get that equilibrium, if you know what I mean. If you can see it in your mind, you've got an unequal scale, you need to lift it higher than to find that equilibrium. And certain people were pushed higher, but everyone else kind of wasn't at all. Is that, you know, when we talk about this, like, rainbow nation, we actually don't mean equal, do we? Because we need to get to the space where we're pulling and pushing a whole bunch of people who happen to be disadvantaged beforehand, which is, you know, the black nation.
The question
here
is, towards what? We're pulling them towards what? To
higher, upper.
Yeah, but towards what? To equality.
To equality, exactly, yes.
So, let me not speak for you, though.
I think that Andrew nailed it.
Yeah.
I think that it was one of the principles of the Rainbow Nation to undo an unjust system, which if we're talking about the film, looks at the ways in which that unjust system was not undone.
And that's where the court case begins, is that we've just gone through describing the ideals that we need to be in a society where all are equal, where all are, where there's this equalizing and arriving at an equilibrium state. And so the people then decide to bring a case against those that are upholding the Rainbow Nation. What is the premise of this case?
So there is power, privilege. What is the first? So you have power, politics, and privilege is the first chapter. It's kind of what would be the first chapter in the film. It's called Power, Politics, and Privilege, and that's kind of the point at which you have all these different academics. But before you even get to that, and this is something that the film tried to do, because a lot of the ways in which these things are spoken about is somewhat like, it's like academic and cerebral and kind of inaccessible. So we tried in unpacking the ideals of what the reparation is and isn't, it's like structural inequalities, systemic oppression. What are those things, right? So before you even get to explain them, you have to show them. And that's like this idea that one girl, Lungelo in the film, wakes up in Soweto at 5 a.m. to get to class by 8 a.m. and she has to use like two different modes of transport to get there. And in the route that she takes, so many things happen to her. She's like subject to sexual violence.
Cat calls,
exactly, right? And then there's another girl who lives at UCT, and her route is only 5 minutes because she lives on campus. Then there's another girl who's got a car, and she can drive there. So showing the structural inequalities, which are a manifestation of not undoing an unjust system. Do you know what I'm saying? The fact that there's still like hundreds of thousands of people that live in Soweto is still, you know, part and parcel of the legacy of apartheid. You know,
2 million.
But then listening to the president, Jacob Zuma, yesterday in parliament, in answering some of the questions, he kept saying that you need to understand, don't take these things in isolation. All of these things. So I think one of the parliamentarians asked him the question around, do you see what's happening in Vuani and the burning of schools and so on as a response by the people to the fact that government is not listening to them?
Mm.
And he said, it's not because government is not listening to the people, it's because we have this historical legacy that we're working through, and people are just, the more we do for others, that the ones that we haven't arrived at yet think, you know, when do you get to us, and they grow impatient. So is that, so telling that story of the girl that wakes up in Soweto at 5 a.m., what do you say to those people that say, yeah, but that is, we're in the process of equalizing?
We are, but the point is that we could be further along.
Are we though? I mean, let's really interrogate
look,
that.
Look.
Are we?
22 years, look 22 here. Years, and here's, look, let me tell you. Now, here's the point, right, is that obviously it's not going to take 22 years of democracy to undo 400 plus years of systemic oppression.
Sure.
It's incomparable.
You can't equate them, right?
Exactly.
Right.
But there is still the argument that could we be further? And that's when, so it's two arguments that people conflate into one, depending on which side of the scale they are, right? There are people that will say, it's been 400 years, you can't fix it in 22 years. And that is true, mm-hmm. right? And then there's another side where it's like, it's been 22 years, we could be further along.
Mm.
And there are people that, who will, the extreme of that is that we could have fixed everything.
Mm.
You can't keep blaming our past. Yes, we can.
Mm.
We can blame our past, and we can also blame the incumbent government for not having taken us a bit further in the 22 years. But to say proportionately where the blame lies, no.
against which metric do we decide that we could be further? You know, we've never had a democratic government before. This is the first time we have a democratic government. So what are we measuring this thing that we could be further?
But don't you think the metric is that, and this is maybe a little bit of the problem, you know, a lot of people say, no, Nelson Mandela was a sellout back in the day, and we've done a show on that previously, and relativity is really important. But don't you think that part of the issue is that a lot of people were sold dreams in 1994? Democracy had come, and now everything was going to change in their life. Mm. So I was uneducated. I was living in, you know, either in a rural space or in a Bantustan or in a township, and you know, these people who have now made democracy happen have gone, hey, let's, you know, things are going to change here. We're going to get you free education. We're going to get you a free house. We're going to. So the expectation now is set there. And, you know, as you guys have mentioned, you can't undo 400 years in a matter of months, a matter of years. So that expectation was probably a little bit inflated because of the excitement of democracy and freedom. But the economic freedom was never going to be a quick fix.
Mm.
And so now you've got an expectation. And as you've seen with many things, when you have an expectation and then suddenly you don't reach that expectation, it's a problem, right? Mm.
But it still speaks then to the metric. So what is the metric? We made promises, yes, and they're still being fulfilled even today.
Mm.
So I'm just curious, and I don't know, the people that you interviewed in the documentary level, what did you get a sense? What was the metric against which they're saying we haven't moved fast enough? Because the argument about 400 years is, in that 400 years, I'm not justifying it, but the resources that they had to oppress us were also far less sophisticated. We've got a lot more sophisticated resources that allow us to do a lot more in a year than could be done in over 20 years, right? Look at what technology is in our cell phones, for example, versus the where this technology resided. It resided in lots and lots of rooms. Mm. So we also have the capability. So then the question is, so what is this metric then? And this 400 years thing is also for me like, yeah, but we could actually do in 20.
So you are saying that because of the advances that have made in the last 20 years, this we can't do it year to year, obviously, right? And that's fine. And
yeah.
I dig that analogy and I dig that insight.
Mm.
To speak more specifically to your question about what the metric is, I always struggle with the idea of enough, right? Because it's so subjective.
Mm.
It's so subjective. Yeah. And to speak on behalf of other people on what enough is. Some people would be like, a house would have been enough. Some people would be like, free education would have been enough. Some people would have just been like, I don't want to be called, you know, names would have been just enough.
Mm.
Or, you know what I mean?
Respected dignity. Yeah.
I just want to move freely as a black man in a black body. and move in and walk into a space and not be disregarded or not be politicized or not be genderized, or you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
That would have been enough.
Mm.
But there are still lots of incidents daily that happen that prove that even those little things that would have been enough still haven't happened, really.
And on that basis, is the Rainbow Nation then a pipe dream? Because even in far more advanced societies, the U.S. is an example of one that has been further along this path of the liberation of black people than we are, for argument's sake. We're still seeing these incidents. So then does that present the Rainbow Nation idea as a fallacy?
Let's define fallacy first. Let's agree on what fallacy means.
So the young lady.
I like this. I like the way this is going.
The young lady in the movie who says the Rainbow Nation is a fallacy. What was your understanding of that?
Something that isn't true, or something that is believed to be true but isn't. Yeah, there we go. Something that is believed to be true but isn't. Do we accept that definition of what a fallacy is?
Yeah, sure. Let's go with
what. I mean, like, no. We're not the Oxford Dictionary. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, we can do whatever we like.
I was like, yeah, that's what I said.
That's what I said.
You heard me. I stutter.
I ain't scared of you.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing being a filmmaker. Because you make a film, you put a statement in the film, and the film is making a bigger point, right? Mm. And you are held to that point, you know? So, that's the biggest challenge, is that when you make a film, you constantly have to be saying, do I stand behind this? Am I down with this?
Mm.
Do I agree with this? And in principle, I guess I wouldn't have put anything in the film that I don't agree with.
Mm.
I mean, that is what makes the film. That's what finishes the film. It's like everything everybody says, in principle, you're done with. And I'm like, yeah. So if she says that the Rainbow Nation is a fallacy, which by the definition we put on the table is that something that is believed to be true but isn't, then yeah, I totally agree with her.
It's, I mean, the story is fascinating. If you've just joined us, welcome to the show. It's Frankly Speaking, 9 till 10 o'clock. We've got the brilliant filmmaker, Lebogang Rasathaba, in studio, The People versus the Rainbow Nation. If you haven't checked it out, it is online. It is free online. That's what I love about it. It's free.
Yeah, we pushed so hard for that. We're just like, yo, man, The People... You can't make a film called The People versus the Rainbow Nation
and then make it exclusive, right? So it is free. You can check it out. Just search it on Google and you will find it. We'll also put some links on Twitter in just a little bit. Hang out. And one of the fascinating... Rory, I didn't even tell you where we met, Lebo and I met.
Mm.
So I've been following this guy around just the streets of Jersey, you know, because he's a bit of a celebrity and whatever. Yeah. And no, I'm joking. We actually met at the Feesmas 4 in... at the Union Buildings.
Oh,
they
threw rocks at you?
You see the... Exactly.
Oh.
They threw rocks at me.
Yeah.
The problem... And Lebo was hiding behind me. They're like, I'll never throw rocks at the white guy.
And then they threw rocks at the white guy.
No, but you know, it's funny because Rory's actually from Pretoria, Lebo. So we should have phoned Rory and said, where the hell are we going? Because we actually got lost on a bus. To nowhere. We were like so excited about finding this thing.
It's disgusting that you guys get lost to the Union Buildings, guys. Like,
we were asking him, where are the Union Buildings? Anyway, I saw this guy, Lebo. He's got a camera. I'm like, I know that guy. That guy's Lebo. Like, what the hell? And a large part of your film, and the reason I'm bringing this all up, is a large part of your film is based around the kind of Feeds Must Fall, the Roads Must Fall movements.
Mm.
Did that give you kind of the motion in which you were like, okay, I know where I'm going with this now, you know, like... I can see how this documentary is going to come together. What a backdrop, right? I mean, what a backdrop.
Yeah, texturally. But I guess more importantly, you know, it is a sign of the times. And as a filmmaker, my primary function as a filmmaker is to be someone that's like some kind of like ambassador for the times, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when people look back on this time, they'll be like, What did that actually look like from a cinematic lens? And that's what I try to apply. So it wasn't really telling people what Fees Must Fall was. They knew what it was. They knew what Roads Must Fall was. Everybody had read both arguments.
Mm-hmm.
People knew what we were talking about, you know, what the students were talking about. But I think it was really an honor to use that as a canvas to really try paint a picture of what it means to be South African. Because, as we all know, Fees Must Fall... Roads Must Fall aren't really about Fees Must Fall, right? This is something that we heard a lot about. People were saying it's not just about fees. So at a point in time in history, there was a movement that was organized around students that wasn't about the thing that they were really marching about. Yes, at a very, very fundamental level, we are speaking about people who can't afford to get into universities, but we're speaking about systemic oppression. We're speaking about structural inequalities. Mm-hmm. We're speaking about gender violence. And those aren't things that are exclusive to students. All of a sudden, all of these issues now are being articulated through this one movement, but it's branching out into every problem in our society. All of them.
Lebo, when we look at what's happening in Vuani now, what was the number of schools that have been burnt?
64 have now been burnt.
64 schools that have been burnt. UJ, there's been a big fire. The auditorium, study centers and so on have burnt down. When we were growing up, there was a song we used to sing, Irobejo. I don't know if you know that thing. You want to sing it with me?
Let's go.
Yeah.
Oh my word, here we go again. Okay. No, sing. I've got the levels right now. Just go for it now, you know?
So now, is that an indicator that we still see these things as and so we burn them because so just to bring Andrew in here, so
thank you.
It was called right, which is break it, it's not yours, it's a white person's, right?
You might as well sing it, guys. I just feel like you're there, you know. Look at you guys looking at each other like
I'm not singing.
Let's not sing.
What you see in Vuani, is that still just that, you know, this is not ours. We still haven't taken ownership of this thing. And so we, the people, against this Rainbow Nation, still feel that this Rainbow Nation is not ours. And therefore, we will burn this thing down because it doesn't represent anything that we hold as an ideal.
Mm. It's interesting. I mean, I don't think that, I've never been in a position where I've needed to burn something. So I can never really quite comfortably speculate on what it feels like when your only option left is to burn something to be heard. I can't really speak to that with any kind of like certainty. But something that is said in the film is the idea that it's a symbol of oppression.
Mm.
It's a symbol of exclusion.
Mm. This place that we see as
the very thing.
Yeah.
It's a catch-22 of the Rainbow Nation, one of the many catch-22s. The very thing that is going to give you
hope,
is also the thing that is systemically designed to disenfranchise you because of the way, the rules of that place.
Mm.
You know, the language you have to speak, the money you have to have. Mm. Things that are historically kind of reserved for still, you know, a few people. I think what's we've added... And this is where the debate gets interesting, because you'll obviously have but there's so many, you know, what about the bourgeoisie? There's nothing better in this argument than the idea of the bourgeoisie, the black bourgeoisie, right? What about the emerging black middle class and the many black people that have benefited from these institutions, like me and you sitting here in this room? We've benefited from the systems of oppression, yet we still look at them and go, yeah, man, I don't know. That's still a symbol of oppression. And then it's just like, yeah, but you can't say that, daughter. You level. I can't say that that's a system of oppression because I talk like this and I'm able to, you know. But then it goes to the flip side of the argument. It's just like, well, what other chance do you have? It's either you benefit from this, you beat the system from the inside, you go in, you integrate, and then through that you bring other people up with you, or you burn it.
And that's the rub, isn't it? Is that you and I wouldn't be sitting here in front of these speakers if we hadn't gone through the system. But this very system has now taught us to look at the world through a lens where, yes, we have to reprimand ourselves every now and then, but even we look down on our people in various ways and then reprimand ourselves about it, because the system that has allowed us to get here is also a system that also inculcated these thoughts that we might, that elements of ourselves are less than.
We have to be appreciative. That's the thing, right? It's like you have to appreciate the system that like allowed you to transgress.
Yes.
It's like, you are here. How dare you?
How dare you?
How
exactly.
dare you be? I've had. How dare you, Rory Slam?
You guys follow the bourgeoisie. Look at how gay you people. Look at you. You're in a suit. You're in like something from outer space. You bourgeoisie people.
I can see the picture in his mind of the person that's busy saying, "How dare you?" That's the problem.
What's the picture there? What is the picture there?
The thing is, I'm not in his head, but I can see what's happening in his mind, right? Because we've all had our "I dare you" moments. Right.
After everything I've done. After everything.
ever given you, ever in the world.
How are you going to come out to a girl?
We had that. We had that just a few shows ago, right? So I came and I just like basically turned things upside down and like. And we had a lot of people. I'm like, oh my goodness.
Sorry.
How dare you, Gareth? What's Rory doing on this thing? Oh my goodness. You know, it's that.
I love that accent.
And maybe this is then what's the rub, I think, or part of the rub of the people versus the Rainbow Nation is that it's this constant conflict, not just with an external factor, but it's also an internal battle with yourself. That manifests itself in the burning. What we see in the burning of buildings is also tends to be a burning inside of just this internal conflict, because the system that you're opposed to has now become a part of you as well, and you're trying to expel it from you, and try and recreate the system externally as well. Is that the sense? So I know you can't speak on you've got your wokeness on lockdown, right? You're like, I cannot speak on behalf of the people and all of that. Like that's brilliant. But in your own opinion, looking at what you saw during the film, was that the sense that you got that what we're looking at here is both an external, but also an internal conflict of the people?
Yeah, I mean it's a very difficult thing to navigate constantly, you know, being on either side, you know, in ways in which your proximity to whiteness and is something that granted you access, you know. And I guess the thing that people spoke about, didn't even make it into film, dude, there was so much content. There was like five films in that film. Is at what cost, you know, at what cost do we speak like this? Or at what cost did, you know, you had to go to the school that you had to go to and succeed in the way that you did? It wasn't like...
How do you know that he's part of the bourgeoisie? You're talking like it's we, you know. Maybe it's just you.
Maybe it's just me.
me and
the other guys I went to high school with and varsity with. And people that I see, that I judge, that I'm just like, you are so...
Yeah,
you know, because there's the stratification. There's that you create some kind of even within yourselves.
But I'm interested in this whole thing, Lebo. Just you're raising a whole bunch of points, and if you've just joined us, welcome to the show. I know we're deep in conversation here. I don't want to break it too many times, but we're talking about, is the Rainbow Nation a fallacy? Lebo Hangrastaba is our guest today this morning. I'm interested in this idea. You know, you spoke about whiteness and our proximity to whiteness. Is it proximity to white people who carry an attitude of whiteness? Are there people in your mind, and I'm asking for your opinion specifically, are all whites just carrying a whole bunch of whiteness, and there's no like real woke whites, but we just don't want to say it? Like, I mean, is that the feeling, you know?
What do you think?
No, I'm the interviewer here. I'm not the one who's on trial here.
No,
I'm not the interviewer.
No, Andrew, what do you think?
Oh, now Rory, are you ganging up here?
I can't speak on behalf of...
No, I'm interested in you, in your opinion. Tell me what you think.
Maybe you tell me, what do you understand when people... There's a lot of talk about like whiteness and whatever. What do you understand by that? Like, and how do you think that as someone that carries that structural form of power just through your... People are like, yeah, I was born like this. I didn't ask for this.
Yes. Yeah, your white character from Fuller is just...
Yeah, I didn't...
Killed me. Killed me, man.
She kills everybody.
Killed me, man. Wow. is that how we... is that how we're seen? Oh, my God.
No. But, I guess I've never had the opportunity to find out what it means or feels like. I mean, I've read it online because it's now the time to... you know, dismantle all of that stuff as a white person through social media.
Yeah.
It's a powerful tool, but I don't... What does it
feel like. I can tell you what it feels like to be a black person living in South Africa every day, but when you speak of whiteness, that's your thing. What does that feel like?
So I can't speak on behalf of all white people.
I feel like you're just mocking me.
No, but it's true, it's true. But I think, I'll be honest with you, I've battled with it for a number of years now as to what it means to be white in South Africa. And up until last year, I was very much like, I'm not one of those people. You know, I'm not that guy. You know, like, yes, there are those white people, but I'm not one of them, you know?
You speak and, like Zulu and
you know, I'm trying, I'm trying, you know?
You're the pariah.
That's what I thought. And it was funny, I met this, like, really hectic activist from the States. This white guy who's based in Baltimore and, like, had a huge, huge activist history. And I was speaking to him, and I was like, you know, like, this is how I feel. I don't feel like I want to be in this white skin. And that's so weird to say. Like, how can you be outside of your white skin, you know? Mm. And he said, no, there's your problem right there. You have to own being white because you are white.
Mm.
Duh. Like, and it was a woken moment for me because it's very easy for someone like me who thinks he's woke to be like, yeah, well, let me tell you how it really is, okay? Mm. Like, I'm a better white than other white people, so I'm going to tell you what you're doing right and wrong. And that's absolute bullshit, right? Like, I'm doing things wrong every day. Mm. I don't believe that racism is a yes-no answer. You are racist or you are not racist. Racism is a spectrum, and it's based on societal norms. So we are all on that spectrum, including myself. As I said last week to Rory, like, I was one of those guys that was like, no, I have nothing against black women. I mean, Beyonce, she's so hot, right? This is when I'm a little teenager. But I'm just not attracted to black women, or I'm not attracted to brown eyes, or, and that's just bullshit. That's just like, I've been socially trained to think that black people are a certain way. And now it's about unlearning that training. And it's it will be a lifetime process, and I probably won't get it right. So I think that South Africa, we talk about whiteness because we're just trying to be nice. You know what I mean? I think whites and whiteness are the same thing.
Mm.
And they're on a level, they're on a scale. They're just on a scale of things. I don't know. That's just me.
Mm.
And I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that's definitely how I feel.
Mm.
Rory, what do you think? You've been very quiet there. You've been very quiet.
No, this is a new me, you know. I let everything out.
Oh, this is a new you from 2 weeks ago. Okay.
I did not know we're allowed to bring new me. I'm also working on a new me.
We're all in therapy. Okay, fair enough.
So I get this idea of proximity to whiteness and so on. But, I still think there is... Lebo at the beginning mentioned this thing that the Rainbow Nation and those that underpin its existence, its continued existence as a fallacy, are beyond just black, are beyond just white people. It's black people and so on. So the question is, when we begin to frame it as whiteness, do we then exclude all these other elements, and do we allow ourselves, lull ourselves into a false comfort of saying, if we can get rid of whiteness, we're done. Mm. Whereas, you know, the thing that underpins whiteness and the negativity behind whiteness can be transferred, is a transferable disease in a way, right? And we're seeing it transferred into black people.
Do you think it's an attitude rather than a color of skin?
I don't know. I think an attitude just feels too shallow. Mm. There's something just much deeper that needs to be dealt with. And I think the question is that, what is that thing? In the documentary, the people that you interviewed, do you think they came close to articulating what this thing is?
There's a professor from Wits who goes, it's the way in which society was formed and the people whose image it was formed in as far as social graces go. So the idea that the world operates for your comfort, and I'm literally quoting directly from the film, from Melissa Stain, Professor Melissa Stain, the idea that the world operates for your comfort, socially, security, financially, and that this is the proper way things should be, is the condition. It's a condition. She describes it as a condition of, like, the condition of whiteness, which is this. It's a belief system.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not
a skin color.
It's a certain entitlement.
Mm.
And to speak to the point that you just raised, is it transferable? There are people that now would believe, and
as far as the Rainbow Nation and the fallacy, there is a role that whiteness plays in it, and there is a role in which, you know, again, it's a power thing. Mm. So the people that are in power right now, the people that are in positions of power, have done their bit to make it clear that we don't live in a Rainbow Nation, because the way in which money is spent in South Africa.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm. Mm.
The way money is spent in South Africa, particularly in I'm talking about the very small black middle class. You know?
Mm.
I mean, you see that stuff.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
hurts yeah. when you see, like, and it's funny.
Yeah.
For a little while, but then you think about the deep hurt when you see on Instagram a receipt from a club when people spend like 180,000 rand on alcohol.
Yeah.
Or you see. And these are the little ones. I'm not even talking about the stuff that's happening.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
At a, you know, governance.
Yeah,
governance,
yeah,
man. Yeah. How money is spent.
Mm.
I still don't know. We're not good with money yet.
Mm.
We're not good with money.
Who's we? Just so it's clear.
I think to be clear, I think as the black middle class, we still haven't organized well enough. The small 1% that are in positions of power, we're not organized well enough to. I mean, this thing with the waitress in
Cape Town. Cafe,
don't
whatever,
get us that.
Okay, please.
No. I just
two shows ago started and finished.
it's indicative of why, how, in the ways in which white people understand
power and money.
Yeah, raise money for an upset waitress. Mm. No one. We should have been like, okay, you guys are gonna raise money for your girl.
We're gonna,
yeah,
exactly.
And that is a fundamental understanding of the of money and how money can work and how it can empower.
Because ultimately, it was a power play. It wasn't about the waitress, right?
No.
It became a power play and became a certain sect of the of society saying, we're going to show you what we can do with.
Yeah, just, if you, just messing a little
if
bit.
You dare,
yes,
mess with one of ours,
yes,
we'll show you how we can organize through money,
exactly,
to elevate the plight of one of ours.
I want to come back to Professor Melissa Steyn. The Mail and Guardian says, to use the old cliche, the people versus the Rainbow Nation is a roller coaster ride, but instead of pulling you in from the brink, it is one that you are safely observing as a spectator from the outside. You will not be moved to tears in the way that Leicester might move you. Now, you look at Professor...
You're going to quote Kwane Leon.
You see, this guy's clever.
I'm out of here.
He's clever.
We need to understand the backstory.
Why'd you do that? Killed our guest.
No, no, but
don't do that.
No, but
don't do that.
Look at you.
Shame
on you.
Don't do that.
No. But here's the thing. That's not the point that I'm making. Is when you look at the documentary and Professor Melissa Steyn, you say, she knows, she gets this stuff, right?
Mm.
And then I read this and I'm saying, but does she get it from the point of view of being a spectator, or does she feel it? You know, and it comes back to this idea of whiteness again, is that, yes, a lot of people, I mean, even Steve Biko lamented, a lot of you see the stuff, but do you feel it?
Mm.
Where did you get Professor Melissa Steyn, and... how did it, you know, what was your sense of, because honestly, I was the one standout in the documentary was Professor Melissa Steyn and how well she articulated these things. And I was like, wow, okay.
Mm. Let me answer both questions. The first question is, can she ever know? No, she'll never know.
Mm.
And neither does she claim to ever know, which is fine.
Mm.
Where did I find her? Through a series of pre-interviews that I had done with people in the film. And it poses a very interesting question that is brought up as a criticism of the film, where you don't have enough people disagreeing. Okay?
Mm.
So when we made the film, the debate that we're having with MTV was that, okay, cool, let's make it... And not only with MTV, with my editor, with everybody, basically, and people that I respect who came to me with this criticism. What about, wouldn't it have been interesting to get, like, Steve Hoffmeyer, AfriForum, people that are, that talk that are kind of, what would you call them?
Against the narrative that's going on in
this
country.
They're
opposed to it.
Yeah, they believe in the Rainbow Nation, right? They're like, it's been 22 years, we all have equal opportunity. Even beyond that, we as white people are getting discriminated. You know,
On that point, to be fair, they'd say, yeah, it's true, we agree with you.
Yeah,
isn't that just the weirdest thing? They would support you and say, yes, we're against this idea of Rainbow Nation.
On the flip side, as an extreme, right? So then we have this long debate about what kind of a film do we make, right? Do we have a film which is a debate where you'd have the AfriForum and the people that are for the Rainbow Nation, and then you'd have the people like Melissa, then you'd have, I guess, what would be before, like Millie and whoever and the other people that are in the film that are against the Rainbow Nation, and set them up as a debate. But two things. One, I don't want to make that film, let alone watch that film, because I'm not interested in a film that will debate things. Because the film, if you think about what makes it so good, is not because it's a nice film to watch. It's important in the way in which it's going to equip young people with a lexicon of how to navigate all of these issues, right? Mm. If you had made a film that was, the basis of it was a debate, people weren't going to learn anything.
Confused.
Exactly. And because of how power works, white people would have seen the film and be like, exactly.
Yes.
And then they wouldn't have heard anything else in the film. And again, that's not a very interesting film. You want, and if people say it's a one-sided narrative, I'm like, that's fine.
Create your own narrative.
Yeah. Mm. I'm like, they're like, yeah, what about the other voices? I'm like, they have so many platforms.
Yeah.
They have 400 years worth of platforms to voice, you know? Mm. Give us this one thing. Give us just an hour where we can just state our case as the people.
Yeah.
Why, even within this little thing that we have, which is just a 1-hour documentary, would we now want to go set it up as a debate? Mm. You know what I'm saying? Mm. So to answer your question about where did Melissa and Kelly and the white people that are in the film, because I've got a lot of like, yeah, but those white people, what about, we want to, I was like, because people would love nothing more. I think there's a lot of satisfaction.
People love a train smash.
And there's nothing that would make like more sensationalism than watching people, white people be shamed, white people be embarrassed. And I think that a lot of people expected that from the film, because I think there's a lot of satisfaction in like calling racists out on in the comment section, proving people's like privilege or like people's blind sides. I think people get a lot of satisfaction in that, you know? And I don't know if I also was also interested in making a film that was going to be race baiting or anything like that. So when you asked me where did those people come from, I said to Millie and Nova and Danielle and all the people that I pre-interviewed, I was like, okay, if there were white people in the film, who would you who? And then they gave me a list of people that would further the conversation. So even if you say, okay, this film is a predominantly black narrative, I'm like, no, because there are other white people that are also saying this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And as if you're a white person and you haven't been conditioned or programmed to listen to black people, here's one of yours that will tell you the thing that we're saying.
Yeah.
So then you're like, well, okay, well then really how one-sided is it? Do you know what I'm saying?
So the film doesn't just focus on race, right? So there's a part where you're talking about this lesson, this education, the edumacation of the people watching the film, where you've got a trans... I can't even remember the term.
Sai, isn't it Sai?
I can't remember
transgender. Yeah.
No, so she didn't use transgender. It's like, oh, I'm a trans something.
I'm telling you it's a Sai.
Trans, what is that?
I don't know. That's what I wanted to know as well.
Trans, intersectional,
feminist. Yeah, trans, it was just like, whoa.
Yeah.
And she's like, so I'm just, you know, I'm excluded in this and that and that and that and that.
That's one thing that we haven't spoken enough about.
Yeah,
intersectionality.
Yeah, so what is that? Explain that to me, because I was like, whoa. Like, yeah. I'm still wrapping my head around black or white. Like, whoa.
What are we? Yeah, people see, you look at like the patriarchy chapter, people are like, oh, guy, come on. We're shitting on white.
Yeah. This movie's about the Rainbow Nation. Why are you going to bring us into it like this? Why are you
going to fuck up much?
Exactly. You know?
Yeah.
I think that you can't look at things as an incident. So you can't look at racism as an incident, right? So you can't, again, we make the point in the film that you can't, why are we surprised when Matt Tennyson or whatever his name is comes out and calls people names? How are you surprised that white supremacist capitalist environment breeds racist? Like, how are you surprised that penny sparrows exist? Where's the surprise in that? that's the one thing, right? So we don't, so, okay, so let's go. Okay, so as you said, Andrew, earlier, it's not an incident, it's a spectrum, mm-hmm. right? And we exist at different points in the spectrum, right? So it's a continuous present tense, right? That's rooted in like a deep historic, like a deep dark history. But we also then begin to realize that it's not just about a skin color. Then there's a gender that also has a power, right? And then there's also a sexual orientation that has a power, right? So like, as I said before, right at the beginning, right? I said a film about race isn't interesting, but a film about power is interesting. Because race, you can then argue, well, racism, yeah, at a very crude level, is like blacks aren't allowed to walk on beaches. We don't live in that. But still, we're not talking about race. We're talking about power, right? Vectors of power, articulations of power. Race is the most dominant one. Then there's another one that colludes, as Sokotlani talks about, they work together, right? You need the white straight male and anything that can attach itself to this identity. And the closest, the next best thing is a black straight male, right? So that's the next person that benefits from structural power. And how do you achieve that power? How did the black white man achieve his power? He had to subjugate the black people. So then how does the black man achieve his power? He has to subjugate women. How do you gain power in society?
In that moment, was there a moment of reflection for you when you were
my God.
Yeah? Because I mean that's it. Because that's the thing. Like, I think that's like, you know, you asked me about the whiteness and the white thing. There it is. That moment of reflection that you have is exactly like, what we're so going complicit. Like white people and we you white know, people are going through right now. Like,
you know, so complicit.
The problem exactly. The problem is that moment in the film happens towards the end of the film, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah, like,
so it's almost like, you know, you're into this narrative. Yeah. Then it's like, then she throws out that thing like, whoa. Like, sure. But then there's no one there to support me through it, right? Like, okay, so what do we do with it? And it started raising a lot of questions in my mind around, okay, so what do we do? If women were to come here and say, we are the majority in the country, which they are, and they said, right, the same way black people are asking for redress, on males the same. And then this conversation gets very interesting because black people, we're very good at the conversation when it's black against white and, you know, land and all of that. But if women today were to say, all right,
and they are, and they are.
Yes. If we were to take women seriously as they say, what they're saying now is like, let's rebalance in an aggressive and revolutionary way. What do we say then? There's three males in the studio, right? And they're like, you know, that's it.
We have to say what we expect the white people to say.
Exactly.
That moment of silence, just there, you know, like, you're really hitting me with a white thing. Now you're into the male thing as well.
No, you lose on all of that.
And a straight thing.
Yeah, you lose on all of that.
Andrew Vestal.
And a receding hairline thing. I mean, I'm done. Yeah. Guys, we're running out of time here.
And you're straight.
I know. It's just wrong. It's just wrong here, guys. I can't win. We're running out of time here.
Are you Jewish as well, by the way?
Oh, please. Come on. What are you going to do there? What are you going to do there?
I'm just asking. Are you Jewish?
Don't do that. Don't do that.
Look at you.
Look at you. We're running out of time. Here, guys, and this conversation could really go on for another 2 hours. I think maybe there's going to have to be a part two in this. Maybe we'll put something in the show notes afterwards. But I just want to ask both of you, the Rainbow Nation, it's a fallacy. It has fallen. What does South Africa look like?
I don't know, man. So I don't think there's a simple answer to the question, is the Rainbow Nation a fallacy? In my mind, you know, the Rainbow Nation has achieved a lot. Mm. We are in transition. Mm. But I think an earlier conversation is that, you know, right now we're under bad leadership. We're under bad management.
Bad, like,
the CEO. The CEO, exactly.
The CEO of South
Africa. We've got a problem with the CEO, right?
A real problem with the CEO, yeah.
And a few of his deputies and so on, right? Yeah. But the overriding narrative, the legitimacy of it and the aspiration. So when those words were uttered, I don't think they were uttered as something to mislead us. That aspiration still continues to exist. We need to get our management right. That's my sense. I think it's not a fallacy, but in many ways it is a fallacy.
But don't you have an external force that's also like battling on the management. You know, it's almost like you're a, what's a transnet? It's a half government, half
a parastatal.
Yeah. So you've got the CEO in leadership, and he's got a problem with his management style and his managers. But then you've got the parastatal. You've got government as and they're the white people that are coming in with their demands as well. Oh. Isn't that the big issue? I was trying to do that, but it didn't really work out so well.
Yeah, like, you lost.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. Like,
no, but look, I get it. So you're saying that there's an external. So you've got this leadership problem, and then coupled with that, you've got white people or a white power structure.
You've got a legacy that still continues today, really. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's true. But then the question is, does the Rainbow Nation does that make the Rainbow Nation a fallacy? I don't think in its articulation it's a fallacy, but I think in the way that we do things on a daily basis, we are acting in a fallacious way.
Hmm. Level?
Yeah. What that guy said.
That's brilliant.
It's dope. No, it's true. It's so true. We're dealing with two problems that often get made into the same problem. We're dealing with a bad governance, and we're dealing with structural system of power that hasn't been undone.
That is beautiful, because it's vice versa as well, isn't it? Mm. It's interesting because, you know, like some people, some sects of society will be like, it's government's fault, and really it's a structural fault. Mm. And sometimes government will be like, no, it's a structural thing, when actually it's their issue. So it's so interesting how it's both ways.
Yeah, I mean,
fascinating.
No,
carry on, talk quickly, we got it.
Yeah, man, those are two things that need to figure themselves out, you know? Government and an unjust system that hasn't been undone.
Yeah.
Mm. Those two things that are now in cahoots. Because if you think about it, the ANC is the biggest friend of, like, that system,
mm-hmm.
because they have their cronies, the black bourgeoisie, that are now benefiting from the same...
They're not going to want to break that.
Yeah.
And so...
threatens a lot.
I think here's where... And here's the rub, and I think this is where it just messes with your mind, right? Even those that are fighting for it to come down aspire to be there. Mm. Right? So then it confuses everything, because the moment... So you've got a party that says, we will not take these benefits when we get to parliament and so on. Then you get the benefits like, whoa... Okay, that feels that
quite nice here. Yeah. This chair is nicer than I thought it was. It's nicer than it looks.
So you know,
TV.
this thing is a mindset that needs to be broken. Like, but it's going to take a lot, because we don't know the alternative. We don't know what it is to live in an alternative setup comfortably.
Mm. Mm. Lebo, thank you for being with us on this hour. It's way too short, and you've got so much. You've got so many gems. I really mean that. I'm inspired by the deepness with which you think.
All of us alike.
Ah, thanks, dude. Where can we find you quickly? Give us Instagram, Twitter. What are you on? People want to follow you.
Lebogang Rastab. I got a lecture from someone at Umuzu today, which is like, dog, you need to get your Twitter game up. disclaimer. I Twitter blew up when I was living in China, and there was no Twitter there. So when I came back, I was like, I missed it.
Yeah.
But then there were other forms of social media like Facebook and Instagram, where I'm a little bit more active. So Lebogang Rastab, you can find me there.
All right, Rory. That's it, man. That's a show. That's it. We're done. We'll see you next week.
Let's get out of here.
A whole bunch of other stuff.
Shout out to our man DW. Doug.
I thought we'd play out with Double HP. Basopa. This song. Oof. Have yourself a fantastic Wednesday. We'll see you next week. If you missed anything on the show, check it out. cliffcentral.com/ Frankly Speaking. Have yourself a good day. Ciao, ciao.
Good day, ciao.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.